No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony, and I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to all of us and affect our lives. Today we have a special guest, Dr. Jonathan Metzl. Dr. Metzl is an acclaimed physician and sociologist who speaks, teaches, and writes on a range of topics, including mental illness and gun violence, race and whiteness in America, health and health care. Dr. Metzl is the author of several books, but the one that we want to talk to him about today is his groundbreaking book, Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. This is a New York Times bestseller and won the book award for the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award. So I could go on and on about this guy. Really, his resume is so long that it would take up the whole show. But welcome, Dr. Metzl. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much. It's really my honor.
Well, first, before we get started, define what you mean by when we're talking about white people. Define what whiteness is in your book and how that comes into play.
Well, I'm a white American from Missouri. I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, and so it wasn't like I was writing about, you know, some outsiders or something. I'm writing about people I knew and I grew up with. I just try to make clear whenever I talk about the book that I'm not talking about whiteness as a biological category, as a genetic category, anything like that. I'm talking about the rise of a certain kind of politics in America that tells audiences who are often but not always identify as white Americans that they, to be a member of this club, they need to be anti-government, anti-science, anti-expertise, anti-immigrant, pro-gun. And so I'm looking at kind of the rise of what other people have called backlash politics or resentment politics. It's not about the biology. It's not even really about anybody's skin color, although, again, it is a lot of white Americans who identify. But it was kind of, how did this politics come to dominate places like Kansas City or Missouri, where I grew up?
Well, I know right away what you mean, because I grew up in a similar situation. I grew up in North New Jersey, but I grew up in a segregated neighborhood, and I watched the prejudice that surrounded me affect public policies that really, really had a desperate impact on the people that were voting for them, and I really, really didn't get it. So first of all, why is it so important to make this biological connection to public policy, how it affects our health? I think it's very, very important, but explain to us why.
Sure. So again, I'm not talking about the biology of whiteness at all. Other people do that. That's not me. I actually don't believe that literature. But I will say that for me, the project started when I was doing focus groups around the early months of the Affordable Care Act here in Tennessee, where I live. And initially, when the Affordable Care Act first came out, everybody we interviewed was like, this is great. It's going to help me pay for prescription drugs or get out of medical bankruptcy or finally get an annual physical for my kids' school and things like that. So everybody was for it in the beginning. And then this disinformation machine took over that told people this is government intrusion into your life and other groups are going to take your resources. And I saw the same people who months earlier had said, I totally want this free, basically free healthcare. But no, this is government and I'm rejecting it. So I interviewed a lot of people, and this is 2012, 2013, in the beginning of the project, who were very medically ill or in medical bankruptcy, really needed the protection that was being promised by the Affordable Care Act, but they rejected it on principle. And they were also, as I say, medically ill. And so people started dying of conditions that were largely ones that would have been treated had they had healthcare coverage. And so I saw people dying of all these issues. And literally, I saw how it literally, I've all the data in the book, shortened their lifespan. And so part of the story of the book is about what is it about to identify with a member of this tribe, to say what it means to be a conservative white American is to be performing something that actually shortens my own lifespan. And in a way, the data I have in the book shows that rejecting your own health care, as one example, or living in a state that doesn't expand Medicaid if you would have had coverage, is as dangerous to you as living in a house with asbestos or eating in a restaurant with secondhand smoke or riding in a car without a seatbelt. It literally becomes a quantifiable risk factor. And so I started to see how that performance of politics beyond healthcare, other topics too, was literally shortening people's lives. And the question was that a trade-off that they were willingly making for their politics?
Well, and let me correct the fact that I used the word biology inappropriately. What I meant is their connection to health. And that's right. A very important thing, right? Because we don't think about that all the time. And it's an easy thing for politicians to go to the lowest common denominator, right? We see this happening now a lot in American politics, that that people get to ignore the facts because there's something that politicians can trigger in them, some what I think what you refer to as white racial resentment, and right. I've seen it over and over and over and over again. You know, I think as a liberal that lives in this bubble of Washington, it doesn't surprise me when you know, uneducated people support people like Donald Trump. But when people that are well-educated and know the facts, and I know plenty of them that support this man, I just don't get it. You know, I just don't see how they can do it. And it must be right that he appeals to something in them that is more at more of a base level, is it not?
Well, you know, so when I started the project, I'm a doctor, and I thought, people who are doing this, because the performance in the book, like I actually just track the health effects of, I track the health effects of what it means to first reject your own healthcare, which is what people were doing. And I found in Tennessee when I did that it cost people on the aggregate, not even just low-income people. If you were white in Tennessee, you lost between 6 and 12 weeks of lifespan on aggregate because your state did not have a functioning healthcare system, and you were continually voting for that system. I looked at very, very loose gun laws. I was in Cape Girardeau, Missouri for a number of months, and I looked at the health effects of having basically no gun laws whatsoever, and it turned out that was really bad for your own health too, because the biggest victims were gun suicide victims who turned out to be white male gun owners. I looked at education, people who supported cuts to their own kids' schools. It turns out when you eviscerate public schools, that has a profound health effect because people start dropping out of high school, which lowers their life expectancy. And so across the board, when I started the project, I was thinking, why are people voting against their self-interest? Because as a doctor, I'm trained to think that longevity and health and well-being are the, you know, core evolutionary drives of yes. humanity. But what I found was actually they had interests that were different than the ones that I assumed they had. Their interests were in being on the winning team, what we now call owning the libs. I would tell people, like, hey, man, you know, you're shortening your own life expectancy by doing this. And people would tell me, I know that, but it's more important for me. Like in 2012, 2014, people would tell me, what's more important for me is that we overtake the Supreme Court and outlaw abortion and expand the Second Amendment across the country. They saw themselves as martyrs in a way, and their interests were not in their own longevity. Their interests were in power and control. And again, this was, I mean, 2015 even, it was laughable that abortion would get overturned, for example. So in a way, how this played out afterwards made me think, you know, these guys see themselves as foot soldiers in a larger ideological war. And it wasn't just about health for them. It was about power. And for me, that's been pretty sobering considering, you know, 7 years later, a lot of that stuff happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And isn't it really, isn't control a big issue here? I mean, I think that I could make a fortune if they would let me sell parachutes to people that are getting on planes, even though it wouldn't do them any good, right? It wouldn't do them any good on a commercial airliner to have a parachute, but just the sense that they might have some control somehow. We're always reaching out for that. Isn't that a central issue? And that isn't it the thing with guns? I mean, guns is a that's a false narrative that it gives you more control, right? Because not only because of suicide, but for other reasons as well.
Well, but also, you know, people are being told that you know, that a gun is power, and that if the world changes, at least you have your gun. That message was reinforced during the pandemic, for example, where gun sales went up. And so this idea, now what I saw was, you know, where I was studying, I would interview people and I'd say, you know, why are you carrying a gun with you everywhere? And people would tell me things like, you know, I could pull up to a bodega and Mr. Saggy Pants gangbanger could come up and try to carjack me. And I'd say, well, has that ever happened? And it had never happened to anybody who I interviewed. In fact, almost everybody told me they'd never been to a bodega. They just saw it on Fox News as being something in New York. So there was this idea of a kind of speculative threat where they would need a gun that had to do with race, that had to do with geography, liberals, diversity, all these things. But it turned out in where I was studying, 70% more of the deaths were white men suicide by gun. So the biggest risk wasn't the gangbanger or the carjacker, which again never happened really. It was that you had a gun under your bed in a moment when you had a moment of crisis. And so in a way you were literally bringing the medical risk factor into your life under your bed. But on a flip side, gun owners became a really powerful voting block to put in place judges. And so it wasn't just about health. It was also, as you say, about power.
Yes. And we have this problem consistently in Washington because Congress has control over the city. We're constantly fighting on gun laws. It's a very, very powerful lobby in America. But the reason I carried a gun at one time, doctor. I was an orphan. I was on my own. I thought it protected me. And then I got into a confrontation one night and I pulled it out. And the next morning I thought to myself, oh my God, how did this protect me? If I shot the person I was in the confrontation with, I would have spent the rest of my life in jail. If he shot me, that obviously wouldn't have been a good thing. So I threw the gun away because I realized there was no power in the gun. It actually made me more vulnerable. But why can't we get that across to people? Is it just a matter of control, or is there something deeper? It seems to me that politicians always go for something that's, a prejudice that you have. They always play on that.
Well, and again, you know, we're facing this now because, to be honest, Donald Trump is a is really good at tapping into that. Really good, better than anybody on our side, I feel sometimes. And so, you know, but he's part of a tradition, right? What I do in the book, and also in my current book, I have a new book called What We've Become that is all about the American gun debate. It came out a couple of months ago, and I'll be on tour about that in the fall, including actually in D.C. And so I tap into that, and I show how gun manufacturers, just how effective they were at casting guns as an identity issue, not just as, so, you know, you can tell people, oh, that's a risk factor and, you know, all these things. But when people feel like the gun is an extension, and to be clear, like, I'm from Missouri, I've been around guns. My dad was in the Air Force. I was born on an Air Force base. You know, it's not like I'm anti-gun by any stretch. And I, of course, there is a time where it's better to have a gun than to not have a gun, you know, so it's not like I'm anti-gun, but I would say that what the gun lobby has done really since the 1980s, really everything shifted, as I show in my new book, in the 80s when they started casting guns really as a symbol, as an identity symbol, which was never the case before, and that happened for a couple of reasons, but really it's, you're not talking about public health, you're talking about identity. It symbolizes a particular anti-government ideology, self-reliance, a notion of liberty. And so it's not just a health issue at that point. And what I show in my new book is why public health arguments have not really taken hold for a lot of people is because we haven't countered that the identity story for people.
Yeah, they're great markers. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And there is a strong connection. We see that men are way more attracted to guns, right? I grew up around guns, too, and I'm not anti-gun by any means. I know that there's many other elements that go into the problems that we're having right now, because I had access to guns. All my friends had access to guns, and none of us ever thought about going into high school and shooting a bunch of people or going to a shopping mall. So I know it's more than just guns, but guns are certainly a problem. And we seem to be intimidated on our side to even talk about them now. You know, for example, the recent assassination attempt on Donald Trump, that was done with an AR-15 style rifle. Right? Nobody's talking about that. We don't talk about that. These are the guns you people support. And look what happened. They killed that kid right away, but he still shot four people. That's how quick that gun works. And it seems like the media is even intimidated about talking about guns. Has the NRA been able to establish that they've intimidated the politicians? I know a lot of politicians will not stand up against the NRA, even though they believe in reasonable gun control. So you think we're intimidated?
I'll just say the new book that I wrote, it tells the story of the Nashville Waffle House mass shooting. Yes. And it's a similar story to the Trump assassination story, actually, which is that in the story I tell, this is a big mass shooting that happened in Nashville, horrible one, in 2018. But the issue is the guy had been walking around threatening people for months. He'd been stopped by police five times. He tried to jump the fence at the White House and had an FBI file, but the gun laws were so loose that basically he didn't do, and the guy, he was also totally naked when he committed the shooting, but he hadn't committed any infraction except for an indecency infraction for being naked. And so there was literally nothing that authorities could do, because when you have boundless open carry and no regulation of that whatsoever, a guy just like the guy I write about, or the guy in Pennsylvania who was walking around with an AR-15, but if it's an open carry state, there's no avenue, right? And so in the case I talk about, it was that there's nothing we can do if there's no regulation on even now people carrying long guns in public and things like that. And so part of the story isn't just about shootings. It's about the politics of open carry in America and how, you know, basically what I showed is like the guy I write about, he was a white man with an AR-15 who coded as a patriot, even as he was on his way to commit a mass shooting. And similarly in Pennsylvania, it's just really hard to, it's hard to stop people. I mean, I know we talk about red flag laws, which are important. We need them. But there's a bigger ethos about just what it means to carry a gun and how we haven't, we've given up on kind of regulating that also.
Well, and this is a real problem that I've always had with gun advocates, is they're always talking about taking guns away from law-abiding citizens. Well, in every mass shooting that I remember, and I don't know if this is the same one, the same thing in Nashville, in the Nashville shooting, but the Uvalde shooter, the guy in Buffalo, the guy that shot all those people in church, they, you know, these are all people that have no records. They're all right. Law-abiding citizens. So they're not, you know, they're not criminals until they commit these horrible, horrible acts. So, you know, that's something that's always bothered me, that they stand up and they're like, oh, taking guns away from, but,
let me add one point there, which is that, you know, if we just leave it up to society, and not to people we vest with authority, if we just leave it up to society, we see what we see now. In the book, I talk about a bunch of cases of Black Americans who walk around with guns and just walk into Walmart to buy something, and they get tackled or shot or arrested. So when we just leave it up to society, then all of a sudden we're playing to all these politics of bias, of thinking about, who codes as a patriot and who codes as a criminal. And so in a way, it just feels like a kind of free-for-all right now. That's where we're going. And for me, especially after the Supreme Court's Bruin decision, which really made it hard to pass any gun laws whatsoever, again, not taking away anybody's gun, but we've kind of given up the ability to think about what do we mean by public safety, and how can we come together so people can feel safe in public.
Well, that's a real conundrum for us, right? How do we come together? Because I think that most people, most reasonable people, would say that something like an assault-style rifle has no business in a democratic society, except in the hands of maybe law enforcement or the military. It's not a weapon that, you know, there is no legitimate use for it, right? If you're a hunter or you want to protect your home, you grew up around guns. I grew up around guns. You want to protect your home, get yourself a 12-gauge shotgun. You can't do any better than that, I don't think. And you know, but yet we just can't come to the table and get any kind of agreement. And is it because we're so polarized, I wonder, you know, that the gun control people want no guns, and the people that are advocates for guns want all guns? Is that why we can't come together, or is it something deeper, do you think?
You know, I'll tell you something really interesting. When I was doing my research for Dying of Whiteness, and the people were just incredible. I mean, people were phenomenal. And I was down in what people would call gun country in southern Missouri. And I was interviewing parents who lost children to either gun suicide or accidental shooting. I mean, the most searing, just unconscionable loss. Right. And when I would do my interviews and I would ask people, and very often these were people who were very, very, as they would say it, pro-gun. They had guns all around the house, and their kid had picked up a gun, or two kids were playing with a gun and one shot another one. And in my early interviews, I would ask people, did this make you rethink your politics of guns? And they would look at me like all of a sudden I was liberal, like I was an outsider. And they would say, well, no, it's never the gun's fault. It's never the gun's fault. And so they, right. Even after suffering this horrible trauma, they said very often we're more pro-gun. Guns protect our society. And really it's the problem of, and then they would blame liberals or something like that. And so the issue was that guns for them were like a religion, right? I mean, think about people who get cancer and become more religious, or get struck by lightning and find God or something like that. It wasn't just about public health. It was identity at that point. And again, that tied into the politics of race, the politics of just politics, identity. I mean, to be a strongly GOP person in a red state and be anti-gun is to get kicked out of your own tribe. And so in a way, it's this bigger social issue, which I just think we haven't really begun to appreciate. We argue about policies or restrictions or regulations or governments. We're arguing at the end point of the conversation rather than at the beginning point.
Well, and you know, that certainly is a problem that is hard to overcome, right? That people feel connected to these in a way that, you know, reflects their image and who they are as people rather than just as gun owners. And that's why your voice is so important. It's so important to kind of try to extract that stuff from the process and look at the results. And I think that's what you've done, and that's why your work's so important. So before we go any further, tell people, I assume you can get your books anywhere. Is the new book out yet?
Oh, yeah, no, it's been out for a couple months. It just,
okay.
JonathanMetzl.com has everything. And again, I'll be on tour, including in D.C. a couple times coming up. And so the timing is great. You know, I'm trying to speak to as many people before the election that I possibly
yes.
can. But again, ultimately, even after the election, no matter who wins, these issues are going to continue to play out for us.
And let me point out that Metz was spelled M-E-T-Z-L. So
correct.
When you go on the website, I kind of naturally want to put an E in there for some reason.
Story of my life.
But yeah, well, with the, you know, when you grew up with a name like Michael Brown, it's not very often that people have any problem with that. But let me ask you something. I'm really, really interested. First of all, I love Vanderbilt University. My brother got his doctorate there, and we go to Nashville on a regular basis. My wife and I just came back a few months ago. It's got to be one of the most fun places in America, right? There's music everywhere. It's just amazing. But let me ask about the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. That seems like such a great idea to bring those things together, and this is what you're creating at Vanderbilt. Tell us a little bit about that.
No, it's the story of my life. It's my job. In fact, in 5 minutes, I'm going to teach a class in my department. And so I would just say that, you know, I was recruited to Vanderbilt about 10 years ago to help build a center, which is now a department that looked at health from a social, political, racial, cultural angle. So we do everything from, I mean, we have a lot of doctors who teach for us, but also health anthropologists, sociologists, novelists, poets. And we just have a number of people who really look at the cross-cutting message of health. And so it's kind of similar to the research I'm talking about here, but all, you know, we have a scholar who works on the military, a scholar who works on disability rights, a scholar who works on globalization and health. And so we're trying to kind of teach our students to look at health in a very broad way. And part of the story is that we started with a very small program, and now we have over 900 majors. And so it's
wow.
become the second biggest major on campus. So really
wow.
a true growth story, I think.
And is these pre-med students that take these courses, or just the general population, sociology students, social science students, people like that?
We started with just pre-meds. It was kind of a new avenue to get into med school, and we've been very successful. Mm-hmm. But as the major grew, now we've got tons of pre-meds, but also pre-nursing, social work, every kind of grad school, health economics, healthcare consulting. So it's really become a very broad conversation, which I think is what we need to be having.
Well, I commend you for doing this work. And is there a way that people, does the center have a website as well?
Yeah,
you
want
to give it out?
Yeah, sure. It's just, if you just go Google Vanderbilt MHS and that's where we are, or just contact me, and I'm happy to give anybody a tour anytime.
All right. And I know you have to go, doctor, so I'm going to let you go. Let me just say, as a student that struggled from time to time, although I did graduate at the top of my class, ultimately, give those kids, give those kids credit for class participation. That was always a big thing for me. You know, if the professor said you get credit for class participation, I said, damn, I'm in the right place. But thank you so much for taking your time with us today. And I hope you come back, and I hope you let me know when you're in D.C., because I would love to meet you, and I'd love to help you promote anything you're trying to do, because I think this is such important work.
Thank you. Thank you. It's my honor.
All right. Great. Thanks for being with us.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. So we're going to let the doctor go, and we're going to talk a little more because we got a little more show left. We got about another 25 minutes to go, and I want to talk about some of these issues. You know, guns are, like I said, I've told this story many times about me and the gun and why I got rid of it. It really doesn't empower you. It really makes you more vulnerable, in my opinion. But it's not just about guns. It's about other issues, too. I got to tell you. I'm a former Teamster. I'm proud to be a Teamster. It was the first decent paycheck I ever got. It was the first sick leave I ever got. It was the first vacation pay I ever got. And I was horrified for the first time ever to see the head of the Teamsters Union speak at the Republican National Convention. It was absolutely mind-boggling to me that someone that, you know, represents union workers in America is falling for this dialogue that Donald Trump is putting out there. Look, my father was a con man. I've said this many times on the show. We moved around a lot because he was always trying to avoid prosecution, I think. He didn't have the money that Donald Trump had. To hire a bunch of lawyers. But let me tell you that every time I see Donald Trump and I see him talk, I see my father. I see that guy that used to take money from people and knowingly defraud them. And, you know, I think most people fall for it because most people can't do it. Most people cannot look you directly in the eye and say and lie to you and cheat you. It's a special talent that unfortunately too many politicians have mastered. And Donald Trump's done it better than anybody I've ever seen. He changes the subject. He avoids any question of his malfeasance or disassociated behavior. And everybody accepts it. Everybody on his side, they make excuses for him. They go, oh, I told a veteran the other day, I think I mentioned this, that Donald Trump, I mean, how can you support a man that calls veterans losers and suckers, stands at a cemetery and says that. And we don't even have to look at what he just did at Arlington, the disrespect he showed there, or saying that the Congressional Medal of Honor is somehow lesser than a medal that he gave to a fundraiser. I mean, he shows constant disrespect. But you know what the veteran said to me? Oh, that was taken out of context. Taken out of context? What is the proper context for calling a veteran a sucker or a loser? These are the people that defended our democracy. You and I get to talk on the radio and go out and go about our daily business in safety and security in a strong democracy because of all those brave men and women that stood up and gave their lives. And anybody that's disrespectful to them does not deserve to hold the highest office in the land. I mean, he can't be commander in chief. He has no respect for the people that he's supposed to be in charge of. So this book that Dr. Maisel has done, I suggest you read it, is so important because we constantly vote against our own self-interest based on silly prejudices and misconceptions that we have. For example, guns. Guns are very good. You know, you're more likely, if you have a gun in your house and you have a child, it's more likely that that kid is going to commit suicide or hurt somebody with that gun than it is that you're going to protect yourself with it. You know, Dr. Maisel gave a great example of the people that are worried about being carjacked, but none of them have ever been carjacked. You know, none of them have even been to a bodega, but they worry about the guys hanging outside the bodega. I mean, it's just crazy. And I got to tell you, I spend a lot of time in poorer neighborhoods in Washington, D.C., and I do not feel any less safe there than I do in the neighborhood I live in, which is all white, very safe, very wealthy. But that's something that I think we need to get over. I think we need to bring people together so that they can see that we're all the same, you know, and then we can dispel some of this fear that people have about people that are different than them. I mean, it's just crazy. I don't know why we can't get over this as a country. Hey, Don, are you out there? You want to give me your opinion on this stuff? Don doesn't have his listening.
No,
there he is. Okay. Your opinion, Don. Yeah. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for asking. I hope you're doing well.
I'm okay for an old guy.
So you're really asking about how I feel about guns?
Yeah. How do you feel about this fascination we have with them, where anybody can own any kind of gun in certain states? I know you live in Texas, and I think anybody above 4 years old can own a weapon. I mean, I've been to Texas, and I've been to Oklahoma, and I've been to places where these things are important. Nobody wants to take, I don't think, wants to take everybody's guns away. Some people probably do, but most of us do not. We just want reasonable regulation. What do you think of that? You think that's overstepping?
Well, my feelings on it are, when it comes to guns, you know, there are guns out there that, you know, they're too powerful and they're unnecessary. You know, when you start thinking machine guns and AK-47s in private hands is ridiculous. That's my thoughts. But but gun ownership, I believe in having a gun. I have guns loaded at my place for protection. And, you know, we're in a world where it feels safer to have that protection. It's unfortunate, but I find it necessary. And you know, there are a lot of people that would agree that, you know, when you have a state that allows gun ownership, those states tend to have less crime, because who's going to, you know, rob you or rape you when you've got a gun on them? So for protection, I think it's great. But these AK-47s and machine guns and semi-automatics and things like that, I think, shouldn't be in the hands of private citizens.
Yeah, and you know, what about this thing that Dr. Metzl brought up about image? Isn't that a lot of it too? You know, I mean, it's, you know, I drive a Harley because I'm an old white guy, and it's rumbly and it's big and I like it. But I would tell you, there are 100 motorcycles out there that are better than Harleys, right? That are technologically more advanced. If you really want to be a motorcyclist, cycle enthusiast, but it's an image, right? And isn't that the thing with guns too? Don't they have a really strong, powerful image quality? We find out that guys that own guns, only 10% of gun owners own like 70% of the guns. You know what I mean?
Right.
People don't buy one gun. Right. They have 10 of them. You know, I mean, what the hell is that? And I know it's more than just that, guns. You know, the things that are happening, like, right there in Uvalde or in Buffalo
Aurora,
those are not just because of the gun. I mean, because we had guns, I had access to guns, and all my friends had access to guns. Our fathers fought the Second World War. We had guns all over the place, but none of us thought about going to the mall and taking out a bunch of people so we could be on TikTok. Or, you know, I mean, TikTok didn't exist, but for the notoriety, or, you know, shooting up our high school because some girl wouldn't go to the prom with us. You know, there is a different mindset that's been created in America, don't you think, about guns?
Well, It has, yes. There is a mindset there, but you know, in all fairness, it's, you know, there's a lot of fear out there now. And so there's, you know, with that fear comes people that, you know, want to buy the guns because they feel mostly, in my opinion, I mean, they're not hunting with these handguns. I don't go hunting with the handguns. But, you know, they're buying them because they're fearful that they've got a government that is tyrannical, and it seems, you know, the government's cozying up to organizations that want us to not have private home ownership, abolish that sort of thing, and take more of our rights away. And that is so disturbing to the people that I think people are gearing up for potential possible
Armageddon?
It's not Armageddon. It's not. It's just people want to defend their lives, their wives, their husbands, their children, their property. And when a government gets so out of control that it starts cozying up to institutions that want to take that away from them, they want to arm themselves. And I don't blame them.
So let me ask you something. What are you going to do when I show up at the door with the Marine Corps because, you know, the government is taking away your house or something? What are you going to do with your gun or the SWAT team? Or
you'd make a stand. You'd get
government.
Well, you make a stand. It's just like when the Cowboys rolled in on McVeigh. From the Bureau of Land Management was playing around, and people got together and put a stop to it. You get enough people with guns saying, hey, look, don't step across this line. Even the military is going to respect that. The police force will respect that. And unfortunately, you know, there are times in history where it comes to that.
How do we get here from an amendment in the Constitution that says, have a gun to protect the government? That's what the Second Amendment says. It says a well-regulated militia. Those are the first words in the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the state, the right of the people to own and bear arms shall not be infringed. So what it says is we don't have an army, so we're going to give you guns so you can protect the government. So how do we get from that? And I agree with you. I agree with the sentiment that you just expressed is really, really popular in America. But how do we get from, hey, we're all going to have a gun to protect the government, to, hey, we need a gun to protect us from the government? How did that happen?
Well, if the government enforced laws, honest laws, and did right by the people, you know, there wouldn't be that necessity. But your government seems to be, you know, choosing sides almost against the people almost every time. You know, you got groups that want to defund the police, defund your protection, you know, and they allow these criminals out on the street without a second thought. They bring in gangs. Many gangs are coming in from countries that they're letting people out of prison just so that they can flood in over to the border and cause chaos. Look, we all know what's going on. Most people, they don't even have to pay much attention to see what's going on anymore. Everybody is, you know, I've talked to my neighbors. I actually am a guy who talks to all my neighbors. They're all the same. They're all quite upset, and many of them, you know, they're preparing for hard times, and they feel that the government no longer represents them, and, you know, they're going to likely, if things come to a clash, make a stand. Then it truly is the military against the people. But when you think of the military these days, you got to remember what they're doing with the vaccines and what's happening to the soldiers, what the Department of Defense has done with these, when they created a bunch of these vaccines which are harming people and then peddled them out to the distributors so that they could then distribute the vaccines under their labels. But this has all been coming out of our, you know, Department of Defense, military, Pentagon, and people have lost their trust in the government. And you, I mean, truly lost it. I have no trust, no faith in the government. Not even a scintilla, by the way. Not even a speck of trust for government anymore. And many people are angry as hornets, and they're, you know, they're they love freedom. They love liberty. They love justice, but they're not getting it. And so I think this is all going to come to some form of a head, not huge, but, you know, there's going to be, let's say, clashes in various cities that'll bleed out. And, you know, you're probably even going to see the United States break up into a few pieces. I mean, people are upset. They don't want to go along with what's been going on. And our federal government has been overseeing this with our own money. And been allowing this. And I tell people, you know, this, it's hard, you know, when your military wants you dead, it's hard to wrap your mind around that. But when you finally do, wrap your mind around that, things start to make a little more sense and you start to prepare. That, to me, is the situation we're in today. I don't like bringing it up to many people, and it's hard bringing it up on your show, but you asked. And these are interesting and dangerous times.
Well, you know, the thing that I find most scary about what you said, and I think we've talked about this before, is that as a political scientist who studied just the politics of things, you know, Karl Marx would say this is inevitable, what you're talking about, that you cannot have a democratic society with a capitalist overlay where everybody represents their own interests and ever promote the common interest. He would say that the common interest can't be promoted, that there's nothing that we can do except to dissolve into what you're talking about, you know, separating or mass, violence. We certainly see this. Look at what's going on in the Middle East right now between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I mean, both sides are dug in, right? And Israel saying no more, no more, no more, and Palestine saying, from sea to sea. So there's no compromise. Are we headed for something like that, do you think? What happens if Donald Trump loses? What happens if Donald Trump loses? He will not stand up and say he lost. He'll say it was a fake election. Does that bring things to a head, do you think, with people that – because, I mean, let's be honest with it. It's more people on your side – more people on Trump's side have guns than us liberals who are out there, planting flowers and talking about peace and love and hope. So does that bring it to a head, you think?
You know, it's going to bring many things to a head. It might not be the final curtain, but I certainly believe that if this election, and let's just be honest with each other here. The last election had a lot of theft. And everybody in social media and the news and the media and even the government talking heads were saying that's absolutely not true. There was no fraud. There was no theft. Absolutely know it. And, you know, there are many big, smart people, even in government, who've been talking about it, lawyers who've been talking about it, statesmen who've been talking about it. It's just a fact. And if people find that they no longer have a say, and it comes to this election, and they feel that they've had that stolen from them, and that their government has turned on them and become Orwellian, many things will come to a head. Yes, I absolutely believe it, because this happens to be one of the freest, or was, nations in the world. And, you know, we've been able to see what's going on around the world in various countries and what happens when they take the rights away, when they take the guns away, how Orwellian things start getting. And, you know, there's just, this is a, it's something that, you know, has Kennedy warned about in one of the greatest speeches ever made, that there is a military-industrial complex, and it's a secret situation, and under a lot of a shroud of veil or secrecy, and it means to do what's occurring right now, right now.
All right. Well, let me ask you: how do you come up with this idea that there was fraud when in Arizona, the Republican guy that was in charge of everything said there's no fraud? Well, and in Georgia, where the Republican guy that was in charge of everything said there's no fraud.
Yeah, I just think they're liars. I think they're lying. They're lying because the proof is out there. Yeah.
What proof is out there?
Oh, there's so much proof. Oh, there's so much proof. And the dead people voting, and the people that shouldn't be on the allowed vote, and people voting many times, or ballots that are in sequence when they're handed in, which is almost impossible. Thousands and tens of thousands of them. I mean, I could send you such a volume of information.
Well, do it. Because let me tell you, this does not go on. I'm involved in elections every year, and this stuff, it's you know, yes.
Computers can be manipulated now. These electronic voting machines have no place, no business in the elections. They're owned by, I feel, corrupt companies. So do many others.
They're suing the people that are making your comments, right. And they're winning. Because there's no proof that
you know,
any
but we,
fraud.
Yeah, you can look at the surface of things and see what you're seeing. But when you start digging a little bit, things change. Your perspective of those things change. So, and
you're
going down
the wrong you're going down the wrong rabbit holes. I'll tell you.
Well, I believe that the last election, and
I've been involved in voter intimidation. And it was Republicans that did it. It was Republicans that we
sued.
Sure,
both sides. Right on.
But there are isolated incidences, but not anything that would affect or overturn elections.
See, I don't believe that. And if people do believe that, they're going to continue to get their elections stolen from them, and they're going to continue to get people propped up as the head of the country.
What do we do about it?
It's simple. You get rid of electronic voting, and you put out a voter ID card like you have for just about everything else in government and state. You got cards for everything, identification cards. You give them voter identification card, make sure that they've applied for it, they've got it, they show it. Forget this electronic voting, because that is rife with problems. And when has that type of an issue, it's going to be used. In other words, if people can crack it and hack it, they will.
Well, how come your paranoia only goes one way? Look, I have a car. My car, I had to provide proficiency to prove that I could drive it to get a license like you're talking about. I have to have insurance on it because it's potentially dangerous. I have to register it.
But you asked me what would solve the problem.
Wait a second. What about guns? Why shouldn't you have to register a gun? Why shouldn't you have to have insurance on a gun? And why shouldn't you have to pass a test?
I agree that you should
use the gun.
I agree. Yeah, those are great ideas.
Well,
absolutely.
I've heard the things you said, Don, and if I were you, I'd have a gun too, because who knows who's going to come after your ass? I mean, I think
I have no faith, by the way, in government.
I'm sorry about that.
I know. I wish I did. It saddens me, too. You have no idea. I have four kids, a lovely family. This is a beautiful country, and it saddens me.
Yeah,
it does.
It's hard. It's hard. Well, keep those guns safe. Keep them away from your kids, man.
Oh, my kids are all grown up, and they, you know, they have their own arms.
Yeah. Well, boy, don't invite me to your family reunion then, because I would just be too damn nervous. But
right.
I appreciate.
No, I understand.
Look, I don't agree with you very often, but I appreciate your perspective, and
thank
I know
you.
It's a big perspective thank out there, and it's something we have to deal
right.
with. This is the problem that we have as liberals. We have to understand that we've all agreed to be in this kind of government, in this democracy, and that means we have to work it out with everybody, right? We've all agreed that the majority will lead.
How do you do that when a few people with all the money tend to create these issues and they want total control?
You don't vote for the billionaires. What the hell are you talking
well,
about?
It's, but these aren't, you know, these are people behind, these people stand behind these they're kind of like non-elected officials, you know.
Yeah, like all the people that stand behind Don, you know, all the people that work with him said, I won't support him. But people that stand behind him got money. Well, we got to leave it there because we're out of time now. But Don, thanks so much for being on the show. And
my
you know
pleasure.
What we're going to play?
Thank
we're going to play.
You.
We're going to play that funky music, White Boys. There was no other song for this guy, right?
Right. That's perfect.
Play that funky music. So play that funky music, Don. Everybody, come back next week. We're going to have a great guy, Congressman from New York. He's a great speaker, and he's going to talk to us about bump stocks, which he got eliminated in New York, and he's trying to get them eliminated in other places. So please tune in next week, and thanks so much. And thanks for everybody that voted for our little podcast on the People's Choice Award. We've made it into the finalists, so we're really happy about that and excited. And thank you, BBS Radio, for helping us do that.
Give the people their right to vote.